Hey there, I'm Pete Townsend, and this is Money Never Sleeps. We look inside the minds of entrepreneurs and at the crossover of startups, enterprise, finance, technology, and life as we know it. Niall Mackey, the commercial director at TopSec Cloud Solutions here in Ireland, joins the show this week as we take an inside look at how businesses cope in the aftermath of a hack. Niall Mackey is a tech industry veteran with over 35 years experience with TopSec, Nokia, Interroot, now GTT, Bank of America, and more. With TopSec, Niall looks at the commercial opportunities and influences the direction of service development to make sure they continue to bring value to their customers. TopSec have been pioneering cloud-based email and web security for more than two decades, servicing the government, healthcare, engineering, and IT sectors to name a few. In this episode, Niall sheds some light on the gradually, then all-at-once impact felt by a business undergoing a cyber attack, from social engineering and phishing to ransomware attacks. We talk through the psychological impact on those who are keeping watch, how those teams pick up the pieces, and the impact on customer trust. All right here on Money Never Sleeps. How's the weather in your neck of the woods today?
It's actually lovely, bizarrely. It's actually sunny outside, so that's unusual.
Yeah, no, we got a bit of sun over here. I woke up with a pitter-patter of rain on the roof up in the in the attic where the master bedroom is. I was thinking, oh man, I got to get up. I'm not going to be able to get out for my walk in the rain. By the time I got up a half hour later, because I was looking at my phone for a half hour to start the day, boom, the rain's gone. That's Ireland for you, right? You don't like the weather? Just wait 5 minutes. Yeah.
And I take it you came here because you married someone. That's often the way how people get to these places and came to Ireland. Is that correct?
I did. But in 1842, the family Harrington left Alahees in West Cork, actually Ballydonegan in Alahees in West Cork, and went to Newport, Rhode Island to go help build Fort Adams. And my great-great-great-grandfather, Daniel Harrington,
that's a cool story,
was a brickie, and he helped build the smelt building in Alahees and for the copper mines there. And there was a general in the U.S. that came over and recruited in the west of Ireland and ended up in West Cork, and Daniel Harrington agreed to go, and that was 1842. If he hadn't left there when he was 14 and then arrived on his 15th birthday, I wouldn't be here right now. So I thought as a service to him and the journey that he took to travel across the Atlantic and arrived in Newport, Rhode Island back in 1842, that I'd just come back here and reclaim the bloodline. But I also did, meet an Irish woman along the way in my travels and stopover in Bermuda from 2000 to 2005. So
Bermuda. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Because I have part of my family actually lived in Bermuda. My mom's side of the family, her brother, my uncle actually was in Bermuda. He was working in the police and he married a local Bermudan. And so they came back to Ireland actually. Yeah. So I've got a Bermuda wing. Still people in Bermuda I'm related to.
Very cool. So. Very cool. There's a very strange similarity between the Bermudian accent and the Cork accent. So
really?
Yeah. I'm not going to do it because I will embarrass myself. Okay. As all my friends tell me to do. They're like, Pete, stick with your accent.
After a few points. Yeah. You
know, so, but it's, that was 18 years ago when I got here. So I've been back to Bermuda once. Would love to get back there because we got to show the kids the place where we met, right? We've shown them plenty of pictures and Google Maps, and all those other things where they can see where we were. But listen, what you and I chatted probably about a month ago at this point. Mm-hmm. And with an introduction from Claire Mason. So thank you, Claire, and shout out to Claire. She's wonderful. She always does good introductions.
Yeah, she's great,
Very thoughtful conversations that I seek to have with people and that go off the track a bit from where we usually go on this podcast. And that with your history in the space of security and cybersecurity, and there's been quite a number of sensitivities around security lately in my field, obviously in crypto, where there's no such thing as cybersecurity. It's just all security, right? Because there's nothing that's not cyber. So it's all just security. That we've seen tons of things that have happened over the last 5 to 6 years. And, you know, people don't think too much about the psychology of this and how it can get inside people's head. Okay. So I wanted to look at this with you and to kind of set the stage a bit, Niall, maybe just share with us your backstory and how you got to this point and your journey into TopSec cloud solutions,
yeah,
which is kind of the palette really for this discussion. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, it was a bit of a convoluted. It was, certainly wasn't a planned life, you know. So, oh, I'm always amazed these people who have these plans for their lives, and they just do all these things like exactly how they're supposed to. They go to college, they get the degree they wanted, they go and start, and they get the right internship and the right big five or big four company, and it all seems to just like tick boxes, and they go on this wonderful path. But mine certainly wasn't that. But anyway, so I mean, I was on course to be another Irish accountant back in the 80s when, you know, when your parents encouraged you to have a nice, safe job. And I loved economics, but I was kind of meh about kind of accountancy itself. And then in my final year, sixth year in Ireland, as we call it, I was always a bit confrontational in regards to religion, and I would ask too many questions. And I went to a Christian brother, well, a Christian brother, a De La Salle brothers school. So we still had brothers there teaching, and especially religion. So they got fed up of me, and they kicked me out, basically, of the not of the school, but of the class. And so I was given a choice to either go to the study hall and just study, or they had the computer room. Now, when I say a computer room, it was very much pushing it. It was the most basic, you know, one PC, one print, and three nerds sitting there. But I suddenly discovered, like, you could actually input stuff and stuff would come out, and you could, you know, with BASIC as it was then, and I loved it immediately. So I just that's how I decided I was going to go to, as it was called then, the RTC, and now Southeast, I think, Technological University or something, and learned how to be a computer programmer, basically. So RPG, COBOL, Clipper, DBase, 3+, all these cutting edge things back then. And although some of them are still in existence now, COBOL, I've got a mate who's still making a living out of going around the world as a contractor with all the big all the banks and health authorities and stuff, and he's making bank still.
I heard,
and he reckons he'll get to retirement.
People being called out of retirement for this, right?
And that's right.
An interesting crossover point. I was kicked out of my what was called CCD class back when I was probably 14, which was religion. Because I went to a school that was not, I didn't go to a Catholic school. They were called public schools.
Yeah.
And that I was asking too many questions. And so the CCD teacher, this very nice lady, probably in her 70s, called my mom and said, listen, you know, Pete's probably asking a lot of questions that I'm not sure the other people want, the other kids in the class are asking. And my mom said to the teacher, well, isn't it that your job to answer them? You know?
Yeah.
So
nice.
Yeah, I was booted, but somehow I got back in and did my confirmation, whatever. But also then, yes, yeah, the COBOL thing, quite interesting. I almost ended up as a COBOL programmer. I was offered a job to become one, and I said no.
Yeah.
You know, how did you transition from more of the hardcore technical into the more commercial side?
So I ended up going to the UK because if people who are my age and, you know, will know that Ireland in the 80s was very different to Ireland now. People give out about Ireland now, but like, Jesus, it was a different place back then. So an example, in my class in Waterford, only 4 of the 50 people that graduated actually stayed in Ireland.
Wow.
So everyone just went. So I had some, over a pint sometime, I'll tell you the mad stories we had in London of people sharing houses. We had two student, basically, houses that continued off in the less salubrious parts of London. And I actually ended up in the working for the Masons, would you believe it, in Stamford Brook near Hammersmith.
The Masons, like the actual Masons.
The actual Masons in the Royal Masonic Hospital. And it was so that was an interesting place to work. And so but they were actually also quite smart. They had in the hospital they were actually plugged into clinical trials and stuff, like for seasickness and all these kind of things. It was a fun place to work. But getting back to your question, I discovered there that I was one of the few IT people that actually could talk to normal people. You know, so I kind of naturally started, even then, as quite young, drifting into kind of management and like helping with organizational requirements and translating them to the guys of the team as to what they actually want. And, you know, because there's often a disconnect between IT and the business.
Yeah, absolutely. And you need those translators, those bridges.
Yeah, so that's where I ended up. And then actually, funny enough, I ended up working for Bank of America in Richmond, which was really cool, actually, and because they were quite innovative at the time. And we did the first paperless office stuff, and I had this mad Cuban boss who literally used to smoke big cigars. And he's one of the funniest guys.
Like,
but
in the office?
But he invested in us. In the office, he was an incredible guy. He was a stereotypical big Cuban guy with a cigar, and he would take us all to lunch, pay for everything all the time. And his idea of a holiday was sending his wife and his children and his dogs away on holiday for 2 weeks, and he would sit there reading the Financial Times, eating pizza and drinking beer, you know, and smoking cigars by the pool. That was his holiday.
Fantastic.
He was just he was a character.
Fantastic.
Really smart guy. Then I moved on to kind of got into more into the kind of the kind of networking side of things. So I ended up working for a company called Interroute, which Mentos. That was actually really cool too, because I got to basically travel around Europe. They were putting fiber, dark fiber, into the ground all around Europe, undersea loops around, you know, Central Europe, Germany, France, into Italy, and they were also buying up loads of regional kind of telcos and stuff. And my job was to integrate all those disparate systems and companies into one integrated solution, which was kind of fun. I was fascinated by mobile at the time, and I don't even remember the first kind of Nokia WAP phones, yeah. The 7110. So I actually got one of those, kind of the old, not quite the Matrix, but nearly the Matrix phone, and wrote an actual WAP gateway, messing with it. And then bizarrely, a headhunter came along and said I'd be interested in actually moving to Nokia, because Nokia were getting into the whole services side of things, so not just the networks. Like, so I got involved in that and was involved in developing their location-based services offering. They had this really cool thing called M Platform as well, which hasn't even been realized today. And it's kind of, they had this thing of the arc of the day where your mobile device actually pushed you information relevant to what you were doing. Like you mentioned this morning that it was raining, you had to go for your walk. It would actually tell you, like you wake up and say, look, it's actually raining today, so you might want to take the bus or use the car rather than actually walk to the train, or it's your wife's birthday, so I've ordered you flowers and okay. All that kind of integrated stuff. We were actually doing that like back in the early 2000s, you know, so it was, but the systems weren't there to actually deliver the idea, which is a shame, but it was fun. And I suppose it was kind of a whole AI machine learning before it was cool to talk about like it is now and everything else. So
those were early days.
And then I came back.
And I, you know, hear stories like this all the time that, you know, it was, yeah, Mark Cuban, speaking of Cubans, right, that back in the late 90s that he had done the deal to, what was it, broadcast.com, or he was actually the founder of broadcast.com, I think, and that it was Netflix in the 90s, but was too early because the bandwidth just wasn't there. Right.
That's correct.
Like I remember even in Bermuda in the early 2000s on Napster, and being able to download one song would take 20 minutes. Right.
Yes.
And it's just all these fantastic ideas have been there. It's just that
timing,
exactly. And timing, bandwidth, not being able to do it.
Yeah.
And then where did you take things from there, from those kind of experiences with Nokia?
So, then I got married, and I was actually working in Paris at the time, actually doing that M-Platform stuff with France Telecom. My wife's Irish, actually. I met her over in London. And so we decided, while we loved London, we loved Paris, we loved the spaces, they weren't ideal to bring up kids. And so we decided, like, you know, I'd come back to Ireland, and Nokia really didn't have anything in Ireland, but like I said, look, I'm going. So I actually resigned and I said, look, I'll pick something up. So they created an opportunity for me. So I arrived in Ireland and Nokia had no business at all. So literally I was in an office in Harcourt Street, but then there was a lot of traveling, and I love traveling, but like I had young kids and they were very sick, and I was traveling 3 weeks out of four. And I'd seen so many families, like literally everyone I know in Nokia is divorced,
yeah.
You know, and they don't know their kids and they don't get on with their kids. And I didn't want that, you know. And then kind of long way to where you were, I ended up at TopSec, because I had been exposed to security at Nokia when we were doing a lot of the deals and stuff, because we used to use, obviously we would give the whole packet core things as well. So we had firewalls and security on those. And we had the WAF gateways and the multimedia messaging. The guy goes, aging myself now, all those kind of things. And so there was obviously security had to be part of that. So I was always kind of interested in that, and that's how I got into TopSec, because they were a specialist kind of email security provider.
Okay. And that, you know, that specialty is what jumped right out at me, is that, all right, let's just focus on the fundamentals here. And that one of the most fundamental gateways into your business is your email. And that can just be just fraught with risk. And tell me a bit about TopSec and what that business looks like today.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, just the whole email security thing is fascinating because I think it's been around for so long that people have almost taken it for granted that it's there. But as you said, it's the front door for like 90% of exploits that actually happen via email. Now, other things happen, like they get onto your endpoints and all that kind of stuff. But actually, they come in through the front door. But yeah, everyone has all these systems. Like they like otherwise, like visualize it. They've SWAT teams at the back door. They've SWAT teams by the windows. But they have an old man in a Zimmer frame at the front door. Mm. You know, and they're not protecting the main attack vector into their organization. So anyway, what TopSec do? We don't just provide a server, an actual piece of software. It's a service. So we do gateway email security. We do plugins 365. You can have both together because they work well together, do all the zero-day stuff. But it's also a managed service. So we're actually monitoring 24/7 what's happening on your network. So if we see anomalous behavior, we have a machine learning AI type stuff as well. But we also have human beings, which is also important, actually looking at this. And if we see strange behavior, we'll automatically quarantine, stop that traffic, contact the organization. And, you know, and we tend to work with larger kind of organizations who value that level of service, or maybe who don't have a dedicated SOC themselves. You know, like a lot of organizations now have put this in place, whether they have their own SOC, Security Operations Center, actually monitoring this stuff. But even still, some of them will use us because we know more about email security than they will, because this is always do. It's our niche. You can't have your dead domain being able to easily be spoofed, which to be honest, 80% of organizations out there now, I could go on and I could pretend to be them easily. And I could spend an email on their behalf to somebody else, or I could do a spear phishing attack into them that would look exactly like it was coming from, because it is, it's coming from their domain. We make it easy for organizations. We give them advice around our own tiny little niche, email security, but we're kind of experts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to a podcast the other morning. It was On the Brink, which is Castle Island Ventures in Boston. And one of the ones I listen to, you know, pretty much every week. And they had Jeff Lungelhofer on, who's the chief information security officer at Coinbase. And he's talking about, listen, yes, Coinbase have fantastic security all around their entire ecosystem. The one thing that you need to ask customers to do is to say, please just control your entry point, which is generally going to be someone's Gmail account. And that turn on two-factor authentication. Use that Google Authenticator every time you sign into Gmail. That brings you up to kind of like the 99% secure element of all of this. And that it's just that one simple point is that email in.
Yeah. And it's not that people are stupid. It's that these... they're so busy. I mean, I don't know about your inbox, but like I'll get like a few hundred emails a day, you know, and you're looking them on your phone. And especially the really dangerous thing is this device actually, is your phone, because you're looking at it. And if it's on your laptop, you will actually, you know, maybe people don't, but a lot of people will actually hover over a link and check it and see if it's actually what it says it is and stuff like that. But on a phone, you just can't do that or won't do that. You're just looking at an email. You see, oh, it's from someone you know. Oh, Grant, there's an attachment. What did he send me? What's the invoice for? He's changed it. And bang, and suddenly they're in. You know, and it's people are busy, you know, so like this, the emails are coming through constantly. So it's making them more aware in the moment. I mean, that's the issue. I mean, people do cyber awareness training all the time and it has an effect, but it doesn't really change behavior. We're seeing the same things happening every day. You know, the same compromises happening, the same mistakes being made, even though people maybe have security awareness campaigns. And we do this ourselves. We actually have phishing awareness training. We do as a service as well. And we actually try to make ours behavior. And we have another iteration. It's not really ours, but it's something we sell that we think, I think it's all about changing behavior at the time of compromise, which I think is probably the way to go. Like, you know, rather than trying to preach to people, you actually, as they're doing something silly, it actually pops up and says, are you really sure you want to do this because of these reasons? Yeah. And it'll break these different policies that the company has. And it won't actually stop them doing it, but it will actually, first of all, they know that you know that it's happening because it'll be in the logs and stuff. But also it does trigger something with them to say, should I actually keep going with this, you know, and go down this rabbit hole?
Oh, yeah. You know? I mean, I've become extremely careful. I mean, I still, even through text, right? And just the old school text app, you get, I don't know, at least two or three messages a week saying that you've got a parcel waiting to be paid
for DHL customs or whatever.
DHL, all those ones, that on post or whatever. And it's just like, don't click. Just always Google what you know is the actual business and not the link that's been provided to you. And I've become extremely careful, but there's still hundreds of different ways in out there. And let's just take one of them, the ransomware attack, right? And that in thinking about that word, ransomware, being a piece of software that then holds your system at ransom, can you paint the picture of kind of a typical attack with what you've seen and what the vulnerabilities are that are generally at the core of the attack?
Yeah, now people get kind of fixated. People get fixated on ransomware, but the phishing side of things, that actually getting money and getting into links and getting it to do transfer funds, is way more common. But to give an example, I mean, there's two general ways of them getting in. And one is the drive-by stuff, you know. So it's not really a targeted attack. It's like you mentioned the DHL delivery notice. It's a Microsoft login update. It's a mobile account suspension. It's a payment confirmation with an attachment or something like that. A Christmas party is a really good one because people just go blind. They see Christmas party or bonus or redundancy in an email. They don't look at anything. They just go blind and they click, you know, which is actually an interesting social engineering construct to stop people actually reacting like that, because their heart rate goes up and they react to those kind of things quite quickly. So there's usually an urgent call to action, whether it's to open an attachment to verify something or an actual kind of a link in there to do something. Whilst there are systems out there that will check those, like most people have some element of URL protection, but they're often able to hide it in layers below those redirects and all that kind of stuff. And then you're taken to a site that looks exactly like, you know, the site you're supposed to be going to, like a Microsoft site or a DHL site. And like the guys are very good at this now. It's actually quite hard to spot. You'd have to be able to look at like the URL exactly and things like that and other things. For most people who are just really reacting to it, they'll enter their details, whatever, and they'll click this, and suddenly there's a download has happened that they don't know about. And suddenly the guys are in, and they're on your end points, they're going away encrypting data, and they probably aren't going to activate anything on that day, but because a lot of the cleverer ones now, what they'll do is they'll encrypt data, and as you want that file, they'll actually decrypt it and serve it to you, and then re-encrypt it again, and then maybe in a month's time, they'll actually initiate the ransom as you said, and actually say, right, you know, you pay us X, and we'll release your data, and you'll say, oh, well, I've got backups, I'm fine. You go to your backups and suddenly you realize they're actually encrypted too. So because they've actually been encrypting and de-encrypting them over the last month or so. So the backups are no good. So suddenly you're in a catch-22 situation. Like, do you stick or twist? Do you actually pay, or do you actually say, screw it, I'm going to suck it up, I'm going to wipe everything and start again, and hopefully the business can survive? Because it can be an extinction event. You know, I've had people come to us, and I've seen it in the last year as well. Organizations go out of business because of this.
Oh, yeah.
Because they just didn't have the data. Like, there's a really sad one in the UK, actually, because we would do a lot in the UK now. And there were a traditional logistics company, like Haulier, and they've been going like 100 odd years, like transporting goods. And they had employed 700 or 800 people. Weren't a big high-profile company, but they were going a long time and everything. And they're gone now because they got hit by a ransomware attack. They didn't pay the ransom, and they couldn't reconstruct the organization, the data, or they're gone.
Just gone.
Out of business. Gone.
I mean, for the ones that you see that have survived, and just looking at the people side of this, there must be some huge weight to carry on their shoulders that they've let the customers down.
I've seen some horrible things. So I was actually personally involved with two organizations, and these were, you know, high profile organizations that had one was a ransomware, one was actually a phishing attack, and the organization was actually like down for about 2 million. And the guy involved, the guy I know, he was the IT director in the place, had been looking for extra budget. He knew where their vulnerabilities were. We had told them where their vulnerabilities were, and the organization wouldn't give him the budget to actually remediate and to put the protections in place. And of course, a couple of months later, it happened, and someone clicked on a link. Someone, like, you know, changed bank details. They like, you know, it was a spear phishing attack. It was very targeted. I mean, I could actually give an example of one that happens, but, and basically, money was transferred to the wrong account, everyone jumped on IT. That is, oh, IT is not protecting us. He had been trying to protect them and their organization, like his department and everything. But the stress, obviously, of that, like, you know, of actually dealing with that, actually killed him. He actually died of a heart attack in his bed. Jesus. You know, yeah, and that's happened twice. I know of two at another organization, and that was an actual ransomware attack where they actually had the data and they went through this whole process of getting it back and everything. But again, the stress, and then of course when you have a ransomware attack, it's not, you have to remediate it, but then you can't just leave it as it is, because your systems, like 70% of companies that have been hit by a ransomware attack get hit again within 3 or 4 months, because they usually leave a back door. They usually, you know, have some way of, so you basically have to purge your whole environment and start again. You know, so it's not just the work of actually remediating the actual, like, you know, ransomware incident that happened, the data that was compromised. You really have to not trust anything anymore, like zero trust, and actually,
you mean like wipe everything, set up your entire system from scratch all over again with better defenses.
Yeah, you can't trust your servers. You can't trust, you can't be 100% sure where they've been. Like, you know, you have a fair idea, but like they probably, and the thing is, they usually go back. Like, it's like they usually, like 70%, like will actually try and attack that company again.
Wow. And then, you know, for, you know, obviously maybe rest in peace for this acquaintance of yours that did unfortunately pass away from a heart attack from the stress of this. I mean, had you been talking to him about his feelings about all this?
Oh yeah, I mean, you could see it on their face. I mean, like, you know, all his team and the two teams involved in these two different things. Like, you're working 24/7, you're working weekends, you have no family life. Like, literally, everyone's giving you, you're getting grief from everybody because everyone's shouting at them. You know, the business is shouting because they can't operate. Even the media were involved in some of these. One of them, one not, one yes. So there was that. There was obviously the organization that, like, you know, that they couldn't operate. Like, they couldn't actually, like, you know, function. And yeah, it's almost like PTSD. Yeah. I think there's actually a study that was done in the UK by a security think tank called, I think, the Royal United Services Institute, and they actually did some research on this, and the amount of people that they said, like, it's not just about the loss of data and reputation of the organization, it gets a trauma, you know, it is actually a trauma, you know, and some people never recover from it. Some people do actually need, and organizations are really poor at this, actually giving them support and therapy to deal with this kind of stuff. And other them are terrified of losing their jobs, even terrified for their reputation, going for their next job. Didn't you work for that company that had that big thing? And you go, yeah, was me. There's the second order harms, like the supply chain side of things, like their customers, the implications for those. Well, you know, are they able to deliver to them? Are they able to supply them? Are they able to look after them? Also, the supply chain attacks is a big thing now, actually, which we haven't actually talked about yet. But like, as a customer of this company, am I now vulnerable because you are compromised? Can they attack me?
Yeah.
You know, and the same with their suppliers. You're now actually a kind of a risk to my organization because you've been compromised. So, you know, anything coming out of your organization could potentially compromise me. And it does happen.
I mean, like, I was talking to companies a couple of years ago about, and someone just asked me to come speak about cybersecurity in financial services. And I said, all right, well, listen, I'll do a bit of digging and see if I can come up with some stories. And it was just trying to paint this picture of, like I talked about, the gateway. And that you just don't know how many entry points there are to your organization. Supply chain's an excellent point in that for your own suppliers, how immersive is your platform's entry points into theirs?
Yep.
And, you know, you just take for granted the things such as, all right, we're going to connect via API to this platform, to this provider, to this supplier, and that you don't even think about it. And there's tons of things and tons of security audits that folks do every year. What is it, like ISO 27001?
And there's Cyber Essentials and all these
all
things.
That. That, you know, the bigger your organization, the more resources you're going to have to be able to look at your suppliers, look at your business partners and see how they're doing things. But if you're a small business, you're a small to medium-sized enterprise, you aren't going to have the resources to do that, right?
Yeah. And also, it's going to get harder. And this is a thing people haven't seen. As larger organizations get better at this, because they are, like, one of the positive things are that cybersecurity is being taken more and more seriously by organizations. So that's a really good thing. However, they're now putting more and more constraints and demands on, if you want to do business with them, you have to comply with all these different things. You're like, you know, you might be ISO compliant, you're cyber essentials compliant, where's your data residing? Is your data residing in, you know, all this kind of thing? What's, do you have MFA in place for people accessing the systems that are going to access our systems? Because suddenly, like, it's putting a huge cost and onus, security onus, on organizations that never had to do this before. Like not quite mom and pop, but like organizations like sub 20 people, like who have a nice little business, but can they afford to have this level of sophistication in their IT security setup? Probably going to be challenging.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, because it generally seems like it's such a low probability of occurrence. You know, we're all set. We're not going to get hacked. That is generally the most vulnerable mindset to have.
And it's so not the case. I just did a review there with a reasonable, like I suppose a 500 user organization there this last week. And we looked at their stats, and we were stopping an extinction level event virus hitting their network every day.
Wow.
So if we, every day, and another one that's a bit bigger, it was seven a day.
Every day.
That would have actually, Jesus. Every day.
Wow.
Yeah. And people just take this for granted. Like, because things like email security, they work in the background. It's the only, you only hear about it when it goes wrong. It's, we're like a utility. It's like you only worry about like electricity and think about electricity or water when they're not there and when they don't work, you know. And email security is kind of treated like that, you know, that, oh, it's just there, it works, it'll stop all the crack.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of like my experience with Gmail, because I use that to a large extent. Most startups do. And I know you and I talked about this offline before, Niall, is that generally there's this expectation there that if you set up your business account on Gmail, that there'll be a certain level of security. But when you guys come along, you kind of do that times 10, don't you?
Yes, we do. And we will definitely, so if we start like filtering for, say, someone like yourself, we'll typically pick up between 5% and 15% of the emails that are getting through that will have either some kind of malicious content or be spam or be potentially social engineering or have a, like, there'll be like to be fair, ransomware is small, you're probably talking 0.5% of those, but like, you know, but social engineering probably 1 or 2%, and the rest probably just emails you didn't really want to get. They're spam basically, you know, but like there's always a, like at least one around 1% of those, which is 1% is a lot if you think about all the emails you're getting that actually could use some damage, could be keyloggers, and the amount of people who don't know they've actually got this already in their organization, I mean that's phenomenal. Like that's actually just because most of these are in stealth mode. They're not actually trying to take you down. They're actually trying to rob your data, looking for opportunities, like to get, like, you know, access to bank accounts, access to data, access to, you know, depending on the organization, the value proposition that it offers. You know, it's terrifying for someone when you actually explain some of this stuff to them.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, like even on this podcast, right? Like I get, and I may go back and edit some of these things out, but when I mention who I bank with, the different crypto apps I use, the fact that I have family history in Newport, Rhode Island. All of that can be used for engineering an attack. And it's, there is a record of me, of you, of everybody, of probably my 13-year-old daughter who's eating cereal in the background here, of that your individual digital entity as a person online somewhere in the dark web where people are keeping track of that and saying, how many data points can we collect on Pete? How many data points can we collect on Niall? And
exactly.
By talking about this stuff in public sometimes is what kind of gets me a little bit worried.
So we actually started during COVID, because COVID was nuts. Like we saw a 600% increase in attacks, like during COVID. People just went on a feeding frenzy because people worked from home and insecure networks. Like, you know, they weren't using VPNs. It was using like devices that weren't work devices, all this kind of stuff. So it was an absolute, you know, feeding frenzy. So lots of data got compromised and work credentials. So people were started using their work credentials, like, you know, in non-work related sites, you know, because they were at home and stuff. And so what we do now is we actually monitor the dark web for our customers and especially their key staff, like the exec team, people in procurement, finance, people that can, like, you know, authorize things, change things, bank details or authorize, you know, transfers, etc. And we actually look for their data on the dark web to see if they have, say, their Facebook account, LinkedIn, Twitter, whatever it is, all that kind of stuff. where they've been compromised, say they might have been compromised on a booking.com or a LinkedIn attack or so, and that data is now on the dark web. As you mentioned, those people do some research to say, right, Pete's information, here's his Facebook login, here's his, you know, LinkedIn login, here's his Twitter X account, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then they can actually build up a profile of you and how you phrase things, how you send emails, how you communicate, your style. Also, you're probably a good guy, but most people use the same password in a lot of their accounts, even though they're not supposed to. And like so they now have your username, they have your email address, they have your password, and they can probably get access to your work email account quite easily. And then there was one where the guys actually did exactly this with the CEO of an organization. And what they actually did was they actually got into his account, and they realized there was an actual big project going on. And so they, it was in the public sphere. So they actually, when he was on holiday, because they also do it when the authorizer, the one that's saying it, is usually like either at a conference. This guy was on safari on holiday, and he'd been really busy. So they were saying not to bother him. But anyway, they compromised his account. They sent an email out to change these details on this project, and he phrased the emails correctly like he would, because they knew exactly how he would actually send emails. And also with those outbound emails that he was sending, they were also deleting them. So even if he happened to check his email and has sent items, he wouldn't actually see those emails being sent out. And they were also intercepting the emails coming back to him from people. Just, are you sure about this? You know, do you really want to do this? And they'd say yes. They were deleting those as well, and deleting the responses to those. So he didn't know this was going on. He was uncontactable because, like I say, he was on safari in Kenya or somewhere. And so they actually did this transfer, I think, and I don't know exactly how much money it was, but I know it was over $1 million. Jesus. And it was eventually tracked to Singapore, and they got some of it back, but not all of it. But like, that was just a very clever social engineering construct where they used, exactly like you said, they used data from the dark web to compromise this guy's work email account and then initiate this scenario.
Well, you know, yeah, absolutely. Passwords and reusing passwords. I used to, but over the last few years, I've changed a lot. I think up some wacky passwords. And
yeah. Well, sentences are really good, actually. So having a sentence. Actually, that's what, you know, that's actually better than actual even just password. Like to have a phrase or something with some numbers in there as well. That's actually very good.
I've started using the pass keys quite a lot, and yeah, pass keys, two-factor authentication. And
yep. But that's not infallible either. I mean, it's great. It's another level, but MFA is not the answer to every question either.
Well, and not the text-based, because you can be victim of a SIM swap, right? And that it is the authenticator. Like you said, there's no perfect solution, but there's definitely strong solutions to what most people are doing.
It all helps. It's like someone going past your house. Like, you know, if they see an alarm, they hear a dog, they'll probably keep going to the house next door that doesn't have alarm or doesn't have a dog. And unless they've specifically really want to target you and they've been paid or have a reason to go after you, they're going to go for the lowest common denominator. Like, it's like the guy being chased by the bear, a couple of guys being chased, and you can't outrun a bear. He said, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you.
You know? Exactly. You know? Good point.
You know,
listen, in terms of looking ahead, I'm forever the optimist and always hopeful. And that what I'd like to ask people is that, what are you most hopeful about?
Well, like I said earlier, like we've been a lot of doom and gloom there, but things are actually improving. So I don't know if you saw that thing from Allianz there a few weeks ago. They did their risk report that they do, and they actually put cybersecurity ahead of like recession, ahead of conflicts around the world, about all these other things, inflation, you know, as the key worry and the key thing to be monitoring that can most impact organizations. So it is now, I think, once it's getting to that level, that board level, people are actually now starting to, I think, take it seriously. What I'd also like to see, and I'm seeing it a bit, but this is, again, you're involved in a lot of startups and stuff like that, but actually building in the security from the beginning, because, you know, so many people bring really cool services to market and, like, you know, really quick, they're excellent, but there's holes everywhere. Like, we even see it from our own developers. Like, most of our developers in our organization are guys late 40s, 50s, guys who have the old school kind of rigor of actually building something solid. And, okay, it might not be the quickest, but it actually, because of the industry we're in, it has to work, and it has to work every time, and it has to not be vulnerable. vulnerable and has to be written in the correct way. And actually, we see with the younger guys, they're really smart, really agile, but they don't have that same discipline. And maybe that's really ageist and reverse ageist thing for me to say, but it's getting that kind of maybe that message across as well. It's great to build really cool, great looking systems that do cool things, but look, they have to be secure as well.
You know, I recently invested in 12 startups, and there's a number of them that are very, very focused on, listen, we know if we want to build a globally sustainable business here, that we need to get this set up right from the start. And yeah, just seeing a lot of what you're talking about, and that while it may slow you down a bit at the beginning,
yeah,
that it's going to be worth the time.
No, it is. And it isn't cool, isn't it? But like, it means then actually then they don't have to start retrofitting, and that's always bad, because when you're trying to make something secure that was built not secure, there's always going to be holes, you know. And but some of the other good stuff, like the, okay, I haven't gone about the bad actors using AI and machine learning and all that kind of stuff, but also like the good guys are using it as well, and getting really good at it. Like, we're doing some really kind of cool stuff. Other people are too, you know. Around, I mentioned that behavioral stuff there, actually stopping people doing things as they're doing them, rather than trying to preach to them, actually just talk to them when they don't realize they're actually going to do something silly, you know, like doing that. And that's all around context. It's not just about security. It could be around compliance. It could be around just the policies of that organization. So you've those implemented, the system is watching for that, and you're doing something that's going to endanger you or the organization. It pops up and tells you. That's all kind of the kind of behavior and AI type stuff that I think is really cool. There's some really cool new stuff, this new technology, it's a company we're involved in that actually it's patent pending, but like they actually are seeing it before it happens. And so the indicators of attack rather than the actually indicators of compromise when something's actually happening, and they're actually picking up on it before, and they're actually publishing stuff on Twitter or X or whatever, showing that they're seeing stuff before CrowdStrike and Darktrace and all these people who are in this space. And it's better, again, a bit like what I was saying about us on the email security side of things, stopping things before they actually get into your network, like you know, stop the email getting in that's compromised with links or attachments. They're actually stopping the attacks activating before they ever actually do, you know. So it's quite clever, really, really clever stuff. And there's lots of other stuff, I'm sure, that I don't know about, and maybe you know about, that are happening. So it's not all one way with the AI stuff in a bad way, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one of the first guests on this show, I think his name was Stefan Oiger, back in 2018. He was a reformed hacker, and he talked about the context of, listen, turning all of these things that he used to do, not that he ever did anything wickedly nefarious, but that, and knowing the paths in and knowing what to do and be able to turn that around to be able to help people and to be able to show them the risks, show them the holes. And that, yeah, AI has kind of put a whole new context on this, because yes, while there's tons of things that could be done with that against your will, obviously, there's tons of good things that can be done with it as well. So,
yeah.
But yeah. Listen, where I'd like to round things out with these discussions, Niall, is that, you know, we've already kind of covered off the fact that you were kicked out of religion class for asking too many questions, and that we talked a bit about obviously your backstory, but what is one thing that people wouldn't expect to know about you?
So I've become, and you as an American will know this, I've become a pickleball bore.
Oh, really?
So
pickleball.
Yes. Yeah, I played a lot of sport, tennis, badminton, squash, soccer, you know, all these things. But my body, my knees especially my right knees, bits. So, you know, I'm always in pain playing. And my son is actually a college tennis player in the US. And he was telling me that, you know, he's in his part-time, they're playing pickleball. And I said, but that looks stupid. I looked at it, that's for old people, isn't it? And he said, no, it's great crack. So there's actually, I know it's mostly Americans and other people from other nationalities. There's about half the club is actually Irish, and half is people coming and working from, usually for American companies and stuff like that. And we play pickleball now, and I've become addicted to it. So I'm a pickleball bore.
Where do you play?
I went to tournaments last weekend. So we play in Sandyford. So it's played indoors on a badminton court with one different line. It's,
yeah,
it's great fun. And like, you know, it's, you know, we're all, and we actually sponsor the South Dublin Shamrocks.
All right. Listen, there's a league because a friend of mine tried to get me into squash probably about, you know, 15 years ago. And we left that session with me probably feeling like I had just been in a rugby match. And that, obviously, there's no tackling in squash. It's just that rush.
Well, it can be fairly physical, squash. I played squash as well. Yeah,
around the court. And so, yeah, I'd love to try again. So maybe I'll check out the South Dublin Shamrocks pickleball.
Well, let me know and I'll bring you down for a hit.
Wonderful. Well, listen, Niall, thank you so much. That was incredibly enlightening. Really brought me into a place that I just wasn't expecting to get that close to, which is really understanding the psychology of the hacked and understanding, like we talked about, the hopefulness and the upside of this in addition to the downside. And so thank you. Really appreciate you coming out to the show to do this with me.
No worries. And I'll have to get you on a pickleball court soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Niall.
Take care. See ya.
That does it for this week, folks. Thanks to Niall Mackey for opening up his mind to help us figure out why he does what he does. If you like what you heard, please leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts, as it helps others to find the show. Also, thanks to Conan Brophy from Create Sound for mixing and editing this episode. Conan is an excellent media man to get in touch with when you're thinking about launching your own podcast. As for me, I'm an early stage startup investor focused on where fintech meets crypto and crypto meets Web3, and I lead the Techstars Web3 Accelerator. There are plenty of links in the show notes on moneyneversleeps.ie and how to get in touch with us, so don't hesitate to reach out. Finally, till next time, thanks for listening. See ya!